Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Marcia Reddy, chairman of the School of Social Institute. This is our fourth annual institute, a remarkable conversation among representatives of the four major branches of dreams, always about topics of choice. The institute is the heir, spiritually and financially, of our Toa presence of 5 years ago. The institute was created by Robert Rudolph, so it's fitting that it could be perceived with relation as Rabbi Kermit Bethel. As I have always said at previous institutes, working on a project with Rabbi Rudolph is easy. He does all the hard work. But this year was a little different. With everything going on, mounting an institute this year seems so difficult that we decided to wait here. Yet one member of our dedicated committee refused to take no for an answer. All the people whose names you see on the back of the program would help produce today's event, from mailing out invitations a little bit later than we would have liked to preparing the reception and everything in between. But it was Barry Pupkin's insistence that we couldn't let the year go by without an institute, and his assistance in getting scholars that made today possible. And so, a special thanks to Barry for leading this evening. And now here's Rabbi Rudolph, who will introduce our scholars, and following their individual presentations, lead a discussion among all of us. All of our speakers, all of our scholars today, come from less than 15 miles away, which shows that for inspiration and wisdom, sometimes you have to look no farther than you can let go.
Welcome, everybody, for the beginning, and I think it'll be a special day. This Torah Institute, from day one, had certain underlying principles. One was that Torah study for its own sake is an important value. Two, that the Torah speaks to issues of our day. We need to use it as a prism for looking at them. Three, that we want to approach our Torah study with a spectrum of views about whatever topic we choose, and invite the community to join us in hearing the spectrum. So we've always invited scholars, teachers, and different movements, not that we're looking for a debate between them, but to assert that we can still do Jewish together with different kinds of views. That the best way to grow together is to do together. And that formula has proven to be very successful over the years. The first year or two we did topical subjects. One was the ambiguous moral tales in the Torah in light of the Clinton-Lewinsky affair. The second year, in response to all spiritual searching, we had that as our topic. And last year was, what is the connection between the Torah that we read and our lives? Today, we are beginning the second 50 years of Bethel's history, and we thought it was time to think and plan for what we want the synagogue to be. And so we asked our scholars to reflect on that, to offer their vision of what a synagogue community should look like and how the Torah might inform that vision. So we will have a plenary presentation of each of the scholars, that I read their bios very briefly, and then discussion, and then a refreshment break. And of course, there will be an installation, which is what you can stay for as well. Again, we have scholars representing three major denominations in American Jewish life. They're not expected to officially represent their movement, just themselves. But we do expect that they'll address our issue with perspectives they have developed from their individual backgrounds and affiliations. And I'll present to you an order of presentation, which is reverse alphabetical order by last name. Rabbi Jack Lutzenberg, sitting immediately to my left, is Rabbi of Temple Beth Ami in Rockville, and also serves currently as president of the Jewish Community Council here in Washington. He came to Beth Ami as his first full-time rabbi in 1981, after working extensively with Jewish youth movements and on college campuses, which is where we first met, and also as assistant and associate rabbi at Mainline Reform. So welcome. He He's very active in the community, I think you know that. He serves on boards and executive committees of many community and national organizations, including the Community Council, JESA, Charles H. Smith Jewish Day School, Mid-Atlantic Region of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, National Rabbinic Covenant of UJA, and the Washington Board of Rabbis. He's also been president of the National Capital Region of the American Jewish Congress. He has an earned doctorate degree in pastoral theology from the Wesley Theological Seminary. His work in the community and in building Bethlehem is to define growing synagogues as is. They're well known. We're fortunate to have him with us today. Who it is left? You're right. Rabbi Tracy Kreers is assistant rabbi at Congregation Har Shalom and also serves their Chaim congregation in Cumberland, Maryland. He previously served as director of youth and education at Edward's Akim congregation in Alexandria. Her pastoral and programming skills and creativity have advanced each of those congregations. She also served earlier as head of Judaic Studies at the San Diego Jewish Academy, the state school there, and as rabbi of congregations in San Bernardino, Odessa, Texas, and Winnipeg, Manitoba. She's written extensively about women's issues and prayer, speaks often in the community, and her presence with us today is also much appreciated. And finally, to the far left, in the seating chart, no matter who you see, of course, this is the right place. Rabbi Yitzchak Chaikovitz is rabbi at the Woodside Synagogue of Silver Springs and is associate professor of law at the University of Maryland. He was ordained at the Mary Israel Rabbinical College and earned a JD from Harvard University in 1979 and a doctorate in Talmudic law from Mary in 1982. Rabbi Breitowitz has lectured extensively throughout the United States and Israel, has written many articles, focusing especially on issues of medical ethics, about which he is frequently quoted, also on issues of business and family ethics. He's also written a book on Jewish divorce. He speaks often in this area, and it's always exciting to be able to learn from him as well. So now I present our scholars first, Rabbi Luxemburg.
Simply invented this guy to the three main
that we gather to discuss this in the context, and I'd like to choose that the first few verses of our friend Marty Martin. What does it teach? What does it tell us is necessary in order to build, not only to grasp, but to continuously renew, rebuild, recreate, reformulate the community that topology is the synagogue, and enable the synagogue that is so incorporated to serve its essential function, which I posit is to be that immediate local expression, both in place, in time, and in the life of its members, to be the local expression of the larger, transcendent Jewish enterprise, historical, cultural, intellectual, and of course, spiritual. The word Vayakhel suggests that our ancestors were caused, were enabled to become a congregation. And the implication here is that this experience of Ketuvah is not necessarily the normal state. We remember just in the context of our weekly Parshiyot that this Parsha follows the story of Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. And after the dissonance, which required an effort, a conscious effort, to reconstitute and to recover the sense of community, that sense of commonality and communion amongst our ancestors that extended person to person and collectively as a body, as a folk, as our people, the Jewish people in God. I think that this tells us that our congregations must also be a reflection of an intent, a conscious effort to bring us together, to bring us together each to the other, and to bring us together collectively in covenantal, faithful covenantal relationship with God. So we must, in doing so, we make a conscious recognition that there is diversity amongst us, that the diversity that exists in the larger Jewish community is reflected in the Gerontine and miniature, even within the life of any one individual congregation. We are not all of one mind. All the jokes about two Jews and two opinions aside, we are not of one mind. We have not all lived the same life. We have not all had the same opportunity to study. But we are all of one people. And we all are part of one tradition, that we are all participants of the Jewish practice. But within that framework, there is diversity within a congregation. And therefore, the challenge of the synagogue is to be inclusive. Paul adopted the name Israel, the first word said. Moses brought everybody together. And this ability in our day to bring everybody together across many different lines of self-identification is an important function of the concept of the synagogue. So how do we all get together? Under this concept that there are three ingredients, I'm sure there are many more, but three that I want to like to identify. First, Vayakhel Moshe. That this gathering together, this recreation, this re-establishment of a sense of commonality, of Ketuvah, of congregational community, is impossible without Moshe. Is impossible without the leader, a teacher, a person of faith and conviction. And I want to emphasize faith. Why, I ask my congregation last in the previous parsha, why did God turn down Moses in the request to see God into all God's dimensions? And I believe it's not simply because we're human beings who seek the divine and all the glory with trials into a burnt finger. I believe that it is necessary for Moshe to preserve, for God to insist that Moshe preserve the mystery of religious and
spiritual life, which is a fundamental factor in the experience of faith. Moses needs to be a man of faith, not necessarily a man of fact. I think it is equally true of all those who would be in the synagogue. Not just the rabbi, not just the cantor, but those who would be in our community, I believe, need to be men and women of faith. That they have learned, or continue to learn, to live with the mystery which is the foundation of faith, and model that with ongoing growing and ongoing wrestling very spirit of the name of Israel. That Moses is a model of faith, and he is able nonetheless because God showed Moses goodness. That that faithfulness be joined with the perception, the ability to see the view through the lens of our Torah tradition in a way that enables and encourages that and inspires us transcend the problems, the difficulties, the challenges, the character of life, any one individual, any congregation. Fortune goes on then to have Moses instruct our ancestors. Says, by Yomar Aleichem, Abraham Tavim, I said, Kibab, the Nila, and Sotokam. Moses says, now these are the things that God has instructed me to tell you today. You know, Moses just been up there a couple of times, you know, attending the post office. He's got lots to tell them. What does he start with? Most of you know. He starts with Shabbat. I think that the next ingredient to the synagogue is it must have a coherent spiritual system. And I take this Shabbat instruction regarding the heard of the Shabbat in this parsha as an expression of the essence of Jewish experience and teaching its values. And the synagogue needs to offer its members a spiritual vision which is similarly accessible and substantial. It has to speak to us in our lives. The synagogue has to offer the opportunity for us, its members, to envision themselves as active participants in a life informed by spiritual values. Just as Jews, then he's told, carrying forth in a very large extent. All the literature, all the teaching, all the custom and heritage that we might choose to incorporate into our lives, to give our lives definition as Jews. My executive director, Janet Gilden, last century ago, he had a talking about the vision to our congregation. He took on his door the following quote. Vision without implementation is hallucination. Now you know who's responsible for the success of my congregation. We have to be able to see the synagogue as an enabler, enabling individual Jews, enabling community Jews to implement the vision that inspires us to see. Here, the implementation of this parsha is listed as the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle. That portable place that followed our ancestors, led our ancestors from location to location, from geography and in time, to provide that sense, I would say, of shikun, not only of divine presence, but of neighborliness, of common commitment, and shared concern, celebration, and experience. It made what we would like our synagogues to make of all the places where we live. A neighborhood. A community of neighbors, both physically and spiritually. caring for each other, sustaining each other, supporting each other, caring for each other. And we know in our tradition that the image of the Mishkan is extended not only to places of worship like a synagogue, but we are encouraged to make our homes places of sanctity. Our homes can be a Mishkan. And we are asked in some strand of our tradition to view even our own bodies, our own individual lives, as participating in the sanctity of the Mishkan, because it is through our acts and the patterns of our daily living that we give up acts that are worshipful. That this too is part of our avodah. A synagogue has to be a place where the vision of our Judaism can be offered in a way that invites everyone to participate in the ongoing upbuilding of the congregation and community as a spiritual and communal experience, and one that translates into the life of home and family to make that environment one of kedushah, one of holiness, and to contribute as well to the moral and spiritual building of the community, thereby promoting fellowship, godliness, daily living. In the spirit of this week's parsha, I'd like to acknowledge that our Rudolph was brought together to break down in this congregation and community, making us a symbol of Elah, and thanking for helping us envision what our community and our congregation could be. I pray this first an example of inspiring leadership will continue to enrich the spiritual life of this Elah, and move all of us to translate into reality, the vision that we share. As members of this Jewish community, as part of this Jewish people, by the fullness, by the community, by the community.
While in the 70s and 80s, they sought to make synagogues inclusive
of the full diversity of the Jewish community, seeking ways to increasingly enfranchise and embrace women, gays, the disabled, those from non-traditional family structures, etc. The current mission of synagogues, Dr. Krell argues, is to help their members find meaning in their lives by making Judaism meaningful. Dr. Krell draws on the work of the great American sociologist Clifford Geertz, who maintains that the very essence of being human is the quest for meaning. Religions are uniquely positioned in aiding us in this quest, as they are cultural systems providing evocative symbols with the power to convey meaning and sense of order to our world. The current emphasis on the quest for meaning can at least in part be attributed to the fact that so many of the old structures and moorings which provided a sense of purpose and hence meaning in people's lives have disappeared or been severely eroded in the past few decades. Families, both extended and nuclear, ethnically homogeneous neighborhoods, communities. More and more, synagogues and other religious institutions are called upon to serve as substitutes. People speak of their synagogues as their extended family, as their Jewish home, their community. There has been yet another steep change which has contributed to the current state of affairs. Under the twin onslaught of the anti-authoritarianism of the 60s and the self-help movements of the last few decades, the old model of group cohesion based on mutual responsibility has been severely undermined. People no longer respond to the language of responsibility and obligation. We are largely interested instead in the therapeutic model of association. How can a particular group, institution, religion, etc. help me include myself? The nature of community has become more privatized, more personalized. It is no longer so persistent, durable, and all-encompassing as it was for our parents and grandparents. Synagogues must recognize the significant change and learn to speak the language of personal growth in order to help individuals on their lifelong quest for growth and meaning. Today's Torah Institute is entitled The Torah as a Blueprint for the Synagogue. Based on Rip Ellen Krell's observations concerning the quest for meaning, the loss of family, neighborhood, and community as the glue of Jewish life, and the substitution of a therapeutic model of affiliation for the model of mutual responsibility, I'd like to suggest that we consider the Torah as a blueprint for our souls. And since whatever new insights one learns should always be spoken with shame on ro, in the name of the one who first spoke it, I must tell you that this is not a totally original idea. I learned this idea of the blueprint of our souls from my colleague, Rabbi Fred Gutman, who first heard of himself from Rabbi Larry Hoffman, professor of liturgy at Hebrew Union College, and founder of the Synagogue 2000 movement. Today's religious seekers thirst for Torah. But their thirst cannot be quenched simply by either academic study or by learning and adopting Mormon code. Today's seekers yearn to see themselves reflected in the Torah. They want their life stories to resonate with the life stories of the patriarchs and matriarchs. They want their innermost selves, their souls, to be validated by the books that we consider to be our greatest treasure. The Hoffman-Gutman model is a developmental model that helps individual Jews find profound meaning and purpose in their lives by connecting the stages of their lives to the books of the Torah. Bereishit, Genesis, contains the stories of birth and our families of origin. Schmoll, Exodus, represents our adolescence and leaving home. Vayikra, Leviticus, deals with daily life and the forming of new families. Bamidbar, Numbers, parallels our midlife crises, wandering and searching. Devarim, Deuteronomy, reflects old age, when we reminisce on our lives, offer advice, and lifelong wisdom to the generation to come. By helping its members see the Torah as the blueprint of our souls, synagogue is able to engage Jews on the deepest possible level, on the level of what sociologists refer to as the really real, that which has ultimate value and meaning. The synagogue of the future will need to open its doors wide to seekers of all types, from all backgrounds, and along the continuum of Jewish belief and practice, what we conservative Jews like to refer to as the ladder of observance, and convince them that the meaning, the belonging, and the personal affirmation for which they so deeply yearn can be most profoundly and deeply addressed by the Torah. We need to make the case that their soul fulfillment can be found in the teachings of the Torah, and that the synagogue offers the most direct, authentic, and rewarding path to the discovery, interpretation, and realization of this priceless treasure. Ultimately, the transformation of synagogues will depend on the transformation of the lives of individual Jews. At every stage of our lives, Torah offers us the guidance and wisdom to embark upon and continue the journey that our souls began at Sinai. The new challenges for synagogues will be to help individual Jews recognize and embrace that journey, and to find their soul's home, along with their fellow travelers, their community, and the really real in the Torah.
Thank you again. I find myself in virtual total agreement with all of the very eloquent and beautiful remarks that my colleagues have given. I'd like to share with you, certainly in these parshiyot, in these Torah readings of the past few weeks, we have been reading about the construction of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, and in fact we know that one of the names for the Beit Knesset, for a synagogue, is Beit Mikdash Ma'at. It is a miniature temple, it is a miniature sanctuary, and as such, the lessons of the construction of the sanctuary would be very, very relevant to what type of synagogue we need to envision for ourselves in the future years. And I'd like to share with you two rabbinic texts. One is a passage in the Talmud that points to the fact that each of our patriarchs prophetically saw the site of the temple in Jerusalem, and they gave it a different name. Abraham called the area a mountain, Yitzchak called the area a field, and Yaakov referred to the area as a bayit, a house, or a home. And I think looking at these three dimensions of the mountain, the field, and the home, we can get a very interesting insight into what type of Beit Mikdash Ma'at we must try to create in our own synagogue. If you consider a mountain, of course, a mountain is a place where one can retreat for refuge and protection against the enemy that tries to assault him. A mountain is a very, very good place to be if you're under attack. And to many ways, we have to look at the synagogue as a place of refuge from that which is so corrupting and so debilitating and so demeaning in contemporary society. We live in a society where, thank God, we have much freedom, for which we must be eternally grateful. So we live in a society which to a large extent is devoid of values. We live in a society of coarseness. We live in a society in which spiritual values are often displaced and replaced by emphasis on the buck, the pursuit of materialism, the pursuit of power, the pursuit of control. Above all, when we come to our synagogues, we should have the ability to at least momentarily escape from all of the rat race that is around us, to try to focus ourselves on higher purposes and higher values. A mountain not only protects me from the outside world, but a mountain gives me vista and perspective. From the vantage point of a mountain, I can see beyond the low and the small and the insignificant. And I can have a sense of ultimate purpose and ultimate meaning, which is so compelling. I fear that for far too many of us, our synagogues often don't give us that chance. We often come in, and perhaps we are frustrated by having a lack of spirituality, not being moved, not being transformed, not being challenged, to be confronted with the same pettiness inside as we see outside. And to the extent we have not been able to transcend that, then indeed we have failed. Whether it be, without having to give anyone particular blame, but whatever it is a failure unless we create synagogues that give us this sentence of this sense of a mountain. I would also say, too, that metaphorically, a mountain is a symbol of courage and strength. And indeed, above all, the definition of courage in the Jewish tradition is not to go bungee jumping or to do extreme sports. But the definition of courage is, as Epics of the Fathers tell us, a zeil gibor, a truly heroic person, is kovesh et yitzrael, one who is able to control their inclination and direct them in positive and constructive ways. Courage is what we must teach. It is certainly not easy to be a Jew. Jews have been beleaguered for thousands and thousands of years, and I have to say that even in 21st century America, it's still not that easy to be a Jew when you consider all the challenges that we face. But we have to inculcate within our children and within ourselves not merely a parochial tribalism, be a Jew because we're all members of the tribe, although that has some importance as well, but to articulate a vision of moral courage, to articulate a vision of commitment, to articulate an ability to make hard choices, even when the rest of the world might think we're crazy, and to inculcate in our children not to go with the flow, but to stand up for what's right. And that is the aspect of the synagogue or the temple being a mountain, to give us courage, to give us perspective, to give us a vista that lifts us, albeit momentarily, above the smallness and the triviality that life often forces us to deal with. But we then come to a second metaphor for the synagogue, and that is the metaphor of a field. A field, as we know, those of us who are into agriculture, probably not many here, know, or gardening would be a similar idea, that gardening, good gardening, doesn't happen by itself. It takes planning, it takes forethought, it takes work. You can't expect, even in the best synagogue, to walk into the synagogue and be instantly inspired. There is work and there's commitment that one has to do. If you sow, you reap. If you don't sow, you don't reap. Misha Mechim, the Arab Shabbat, he who prepares on Friday, Yochal b'Shabbat, will be able to eat on Shabbat on Saturday. If you don't prepare on Friday, there won't be food. So the field metaphor reminds us that our Judaism cannot just be passive and reactive, where we simply sit and hope to be inspired and entertained, but rather it requires a commitment and an investment of time and effort and thoughts. And it's not just a matter of time, it's a matter of also being willing to put in the effort. Because everything that is meaningful in life requires effort. You want to be a good basketball player, you got to get up early and practice. If you want to win the gold medal in the Olympics, if it's 10 years before you go, you get up 3 o'clock in the morning to go ice skating. Is Judaism less important? And perhaps sometimes we do practice a form of delegated religion in which we expect the institutions to carry the weight. When in reality, what is an institution other than a collection of the individuals who make the commitment to make that institution, the glorious institution that is capable of becoming? So therefore, the metaphor of field reminds us to be proactive and not just reactive. It reminds us of the imperative of thought, of planning, of investment. And it reminds us that nothing happens by itself. You can't expect, in terms of our children, to raise good Jewish children unless we are role models, not only in what we say, but also what we do. And we have to live our lives in a certain way in order that our synagogue will be the way we want those synagogues to be. We then come to the third metaphor that is used to describe the synagogue. That, of course, is the bayit, the home. And this reminds us of the idea that our synagogue is indeed our community, that we come together as Jews, and as all family members, there will be fights, there will be tensions, but we are family, we are mishpacha, and we come together in love, in togetherness, in recognizing that while there will often be disagreements, they are disagreements within a family. And therefore, in our synagogues, there should be a feeling of Avat Israel, of love of the Jewish people, Avat Eretz Israel, love of Israel, regardless of whatever political position one takes on the issues of the day. And that also means that just as in a home, there's a sense of feeling wanted, feeling belonged, feeling that one's presence is appreciated. We must create synagogues where people feel well. They feel that this is a home for them. They feel that the doors are open. And above all, that Judaism should be a joyous, liberating experience. Not one that is simply empty, ritualistic, mechanical, without that sense of being home. So I think that in this rabbinic teaching of the mountain, the field, and the home, we do have visions, complementary visions, of what our synagogue should be, what our synagogue can be. But I want to add a little bit more, because in reading about the parshiyos of the construction of the Mishkan, there are a few other things that need to be brought out.
And again, please indulge me about it. I just mentioned the halakha, and I think that at least a homiletical bearing on the situation.
In this parsha, as Rabbi Luxemburg quoted, we are given the commandment of Shabbat in conjunction with building the tabernacle. And under the halakha, this is designed to teach us that one is not allowed to build the tabernacle on Shabbat. That Shabbat overrides the construction of the tabernacle. And yet there's a little bit of a paradox. Because the korbanot, the sacrifices, which certainly involved many technical Shabbat infractions, slaughtering and burning and everything else, that did occur at Shabbat. So how come you can't build a tabernacle on Shabbat, but you can do all the korbanot on Shabbat? And there's an important answer here, and that is, God says, what you do in a building is more important than putting up the building. Meaning to say, putting up a mishkan is very significant, but Shabbat is more important. But when it comes to what you do in that day, the prayer, the sacrifice, the korbanot, the limud ha-torah, the act of loving kindness, that's it. Part of the mentality in 20th century America, now 21st century, we put a big emphasis on buildings. And of course, buildings are important. And I think every executive director will tell you it's easier to get money for a building fund than it is for educational programs. And that is regrettable, and that is unfortunate. And to some degree, now it's understandable, because buildings are physical, they're visible, and of course one should glorify God with a beautiful building that is entirely appropriate. But we have to recognize that the essence of the synagogue is not the building. The essence of the synagogue is the worship, is the Torah study, is the brotherhood, is the camaraderie, is the togetherness, is the community. You can have that even if there's no building at all. And you can sometimes have a building and not have that. And one has to understand what is the ikar and what is the tafel, what is the significance, and what is important indeed, but of lesser importance. One has to make a choice. Let me also point out that we read that the tabernacle was constructed by a relatively modest donation of one half shekel, half silver coin, that everybody owns. And I think the Machzit HaShekel teaches us also a very important lesson. The Torah makes the point that the rich person may give no more, and the poor person may give no less. Well, we understand why the poor person can't give less, we've got to give minimum dues. But where would we ever hear the rich person cannot give more? As far as I know, there is no institution in the Jewish community that would ever prohibit voluntarily giving more. But when it comes to the construction of the Mishkan, there is a lesson. That is, the other equality in the eyes of God. We come to synagogue, learned, unlearned, more religious, less religious. We come as equals. We come as a community. The rich person, no bigger than the poor person. We stand equal before God. That equality, one of the fundamental lessons in the Machzit HaShevet. But there's another lesson as well. Because you'll notice the Torah does not say, give a whole shekel, the person gives half shekel. The lesson of the half is that half is not complete unless it's joined with another. The lesson is we are interdependent rather. We need each other. Standing by ourselves in the presence of God as individuals, we are perpetual and infinite. And it is only by building bridges that we attain the completion. There is an actor that has been called Melting Pot Actor, and then there is an actor that is called a Salad Bowl Actor. And the distinction is a Melting Pot Actor, if any of you have these famous fish showings on Saturday, you know what showings looks like the day afterwards. All of the individual ingredients have simply melted together in an indistinguishable blob. One method of actor is where we simply give up our individuality to become sameness. But there's a much more deeper level of achdut, an achdut that is predicated precisely in the recognition of diversity in uniqueness, where the lettuce and the tomatoes and the peppers coexist in their beauty and in their distinctness, but at the same time they are part of the harmonious world. The Torah does not call upon us to achieve an achdut, it obliterates the uniqueness. Torah all the time to achieve an actor that celebrates individuality, because if we say there are 600,000 letters in the Torah, there's such a tradition, and there were 600,000 souls of the Jews who left Egypt, and the Zohar teaches us a great text of Jewish mysticism, that each Jewish soul has its own uniqueness in the Torah, each one has their letter, and if one is not given access to their letter, the entire Torah is invalid and broken. So again, I do want to congratulate Rabbi Rudolph on his appointment. I know and I see his willingness and commitment to organize such a program. That these pillars of Torah and Avodah Zarah, divine service, can lift up again and helping the community is a very, very important item on this agenda. And I wish him and his congregation much success. First, I don't know if I can see the Fifth Amendment in this type of but I just want to say that there are a lot of difficulties. First of all, I think everyone can agree on a goal called spirituality, which is a wonderful, wonderful goal. But exactly how that's going to be achieved will vary from individual to individual. There are people who can be totally inspired by one style of leadership and direction, and there are other people for whom that simply turns them off. Now, of course, there's always the option of going to different synagogues, but you know, within a given synagogue, there's always every rabbi going to find that they cannot reach everybody all of the time. Obviously, a creative rabbinic leadership would strive to create various options and alternatives so that things that don't work for some people will work for other people, and within a basic structure. Now, that does take a lot of creativity, a lot of thought, and it also takes, to some degree, a willingness to surrender one's ego, because sometimes one may not be the right one. You have to be willing to delegate, find other alternatives, and don't really be overly protective or proud of leadership.
I focus on the value of being everybody being a family. And I think that perhaps for those of us who do that, it's a positive model of the people who are involved in the One of the challenges for rabbis to do is actually that we have to help our congregants recognize the journey, identify the journey for them, help them realize that all of us, that none of us really can achieve that sense of spirituality, which we're talking about, that sense of belonging and deep authenticity within the community. Within their own views, maybe explaining their own perspectives, unless they continue to learn and grow and develop. And some people may be at least a plateau, and maybe they're unable or not to communicate on that sense, and perhaps one of the goals of the institution is to really move them in the direction they want, and the level that they are, move them up to the next level.
I think that if anything, that and two-thirds of the house. You can use that way to
understanding from God that will work for any given individual who is just
think that's one of the great, wonderful tasks that we as rabbis have. And I feel personally very uniquely qualified to do that, because I came from a sort of more secular background and moved, you know, the core tradition computer to do for my life, and certainly did not start in the place of tradition belief. But moved that way, and continued to move that, you know, as I learn more about Judaism, and find that I can feel used that with people who are struggling and say, you know what, I used to be in exactly that place, and now I'm still with you, and something that.
So coming from a very traditional congregation, I would have to say that the issue of atheism or agnosticism is not very much of an issue, but the issue of God is very much. I've often heard it said by people who are very, very observant that they didn't really feel comfortable talking about God because that was too much of a Christian concept. God is what, you know, preachers talk about. We talk about the smoke, we talk about rituals, we talk about things to do, but we don't directly talk about God. Now, the truth is, there is a kernel of legitimacy in that observation, but the truth is, I think that sometimes we have become, you know, as sophisticated intellectual beings, we're sometimes ashamed of trying to cultivate a direct, personal, intimate relationship with the Almighty. You know, the Rudolph, the verse that he says is exactly on point. The absolute God says, build a sanctuary so I may dwell in your heart and soul. It is our heart and our soul that is the sanctuary of God. That's what God actually does. It is true that there might be reasons to come to the synagogue, even if one doesn't believe in God, one could enjoy the Hagan, one could enjoy the sense of camaraderie, community, the sense of being connected to one's roots. But we have to say that Judaism is certainly a religion that is predicated on belief in God, but not only in an abstract, at least coming from my tradition, the concept of God is that voice within a person that gives a person support, strength, comfort, guidance in a very somewhat indirect, oblique way, to be sure, and certainly the mission of a religious institution is to inculcate and encourage and strengthen that sense of faith and that sense of commitment and other forces. And I think that even among the most traditional Christians, you sometimes find that people do have trouble.
I really think, you know, when we talk about the word of hope, the meaning of life,
time or time, sometimes I try to get another monkey to get there. So it seems to be something that's all monkey, but I have to do it. God wasn't doing it, it can't survive. But I think it's the first time that we need to spread our words today. That is, what do you do in this place or in this time? Hopefully, we become what is required of us, what the generation of children is trying. Those who are the builders, they are using God. They are Christians of open-heartedness, generosity. Just to say open-handedness, that's what we think about giving. But rather open-heartedness, that is the spiritual state, that an awareness and knowing and understanding, which leads us to be generous, which motivates us to be generous. And I think that this is the struggle. I really believe that it's so important for us to retain our ability as stewards of self and advantage, whether we, no matter where this is from, we need to be a part of it, retain our ability to advance. And that is to retain what I think is inherently a theistic, and that is to talk about and to talk of that.
One is about the issue of intolerance. I think that most of us believe about what synagogues should be or places shouldn't be underneath of highly intolerant. And of course, in the Torah, there's people living on Mecca, so in the Boy Kadosh, it will be a kingdom of freedom and a holy people. So, the meaning of rabbi is discomfort with the thought that the intolerance would be so successful. Think about that in a more nervous moment. If there were such a time when, in fact, there was such knowledge and empowerment that we were supposed to, would we, in fact, be supposed
to? It can only be so. And I'll tell you why it can only be so. Then the bunny would be able to function in the community in the way I can be able to understand. And that is speech. Word speech. And by teaching us the very
so learned and so totally involved that they would be able to really run all the affairs of the synagogue and for that matter, all the affairs of the important institutions of Jewish life without needing to rely upon what they told us for their religious leaders. And so, in a way, we all need for that. And we don't know how realistic it is. And I want to say that there is indeed a disconnect there, a good gap between the sort of community that many rabbis in Brooklyn are known for and the reality that we face. So I think that our lifelong task is to sort of do our best to bring people closer, step by step, to that ultimate vision. When people truly engage, truly are learning, and truly are interested in Torah, and interested in Judaism, and interested in learning in Jewish life. Those of us who are successful, I think, are able to ignite and inspire at least some of our congregants when we embrace that vision and to work on making ourselves into, a fully rounded Jew. Those who are less successful, maybe sometimes have the feeling that they're sort of watching the congregation along, sitting in the dream. But ideally, with all of our efforts, at least we can see some of our congregation a little farther up that ladder.
Well, I consider my own congregation, I kind of face the problem that the Rabbi Rudolph described. I have around 15 members that are ordained rabbis. Indeed, I sometimes wonder when I go on the paper that the condition will be good when I come back. But go back to the Chumash itself. If you remember in the Book of Numbers, when Eldad and Medad are giving prophecy, and Joshua goes to Moses and says, Moses, put them in jail. How dare they give prophecy? And Moses' remarks were, if only all the nation of God would be prophets, that would be Moses' goal. Moses, of course, is the prototype of the great enabler. And one of the great, great contributions of the biblical Judaism in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple is the concept of throwing open Torah education to everyone, making it something that is desirable. You know, when people do it, in many communities, against the law of the church, that people can even become literate, so that the interpretation of the scripture would only be available to one particular source. And the entire direction of Judaism has been in the opposite way, that people should become knowledgeable, people should have the knowledge and the facts to be able to debate and discuss with rabbis. But there's nothing that a rabbi appreciates more than a congregant who is so invested in the material that they want to discuss it and even argue over it. So as I said, how about it? We yearn for that day, and we hope that more and more people will get it.
Another question about that. We just read yesterday about the Golden Cat, and I talked back to hear about the different leadership styles. We call them the Moses and Aaron. Moses, the breaker of the tablets and the splitter of the rocks, and the person who really just went forward. He wasn't going to be stopped by any human concerns. And then the Dahlah moved to Obeyshon Marobe, someone to keep her at peace, who maybe there's too much peacemaking and is permitted the making of the test. And I talked a little about whether how the rabbi is a those two goals. And I wonder whether you have experience to face that a lot or a little, and whether there's any conclusion as to where to go on that.
But remember that
whether it be the Lutheran movement, or the Christian movement, whether it be the religious movement, or any other type of ideology, has to come to consensus. It has to demand that people agree. It has to demand a consensus. I think that I found my confidence in this regard. Asking for anything meaningful that they do in their lives, vocational or avocational, it doesn't require something extraordinary. It's because the biggest good is still struggling. Struggling is happy to open. And if they don't have to be interested in that,
Ultimately, I think that one of the reasons that
I can't remember what it was. God. If you ever had the vision that we would all be able to dive into the things we know. In other words, when they built the new temple in the time of the Torah, and then the temple order wasn't orthodox, it's got a conservative one and a reform one. But the other things that they, I don't know who, and we might find a common place to be and what that would look like.
As
the tradition of Burmese culture. The Hoga to the life of Torah and to the life of God's inspiration creates an entire rainbow of possibilities. And if you took away any one of those dreams, any one of those colors, you would really not be powerless the grandeur and the beauty of the whole. So I sort of like the fact that there are all these different options available. By the way, in Cumberland, we have three different universities.
Now, you talked about the fact that there was only one who's done, and we have separate from the stand for what we have to say before. Now, I remember visiting the class, the great Kabbalist, the Ari, Lewis, and there's an Ari Ashkenazi show, and Ari's wife, so he's one of the Ari's great there. So, who knows how many of you have done that? I think, my position would have to be very close to Rabbi Clear's position on this. Because of various halachic reasons, simply have a consolidated service, I don't think it's impossible at this juncture, but neither would it be desired. Beauty of Judaism, camaraderie, diversity, and we have to recognize that in spite of the many, many differences that we have, we do share a Torah, and it is the study of Torah that can unite us, bring us together, and provide a common contextual platform. We can interested to discuss all the differences between us as well as all that tonight. We need more questions like this, and we think we're all under the same roof, and we are all talking.